for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The life of Frank Sinatra was filled with music, women, and plenty of Jack Daniels to match. 5 years after the biography, Frank the Voice, became a bestseller, author James Kaplan has come out with his second and final volume on the famous crooner. Kaplan offers a close-up of the man known as Old Blue Eyes, his career highs and lows, his affairs with Hollywood royalty, his exploits with the Rat Pack, and his legacy to American culture. The book is titled Sinatra, the Chairman. James Kaplan joins me in the studio. I do invite you, as always, to be part of the program. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and we will have some favorite Sinatra hits to play for you during this hour. James Kaplan, it's good to see you.
It's wonderful to be here, Diane.
Thank you. I must say, this, as I've already said, is your second final volume. In the first, you went through Sinatra's early years. Give us a rough outline of what those early years were like.
The first book is really a story about the rise of a romantic young troubadour. You know, he's a big band singer until he became so big with Tommy Dorsey that he went out on his own, which no singer had ever done before, and that effectively ended the big band era. The problem was that he made his greatest success early on during World War II with these ballads of longing, when all America was thinking about the boys fighting overseas. When the war was over, suddenly, very suddenly, abruptly, American musical tastes changed. So the first thing that happened, the first bad thing that happened to him after the war, was that his records stopped selling. Then there were about five separate self-inflicted problems that cropped up after that, and his career really went down the tubes.
How long was he married to his first wife, Nancy?
They were married from 1939 until 1950. That was when she changed the locks and called a lawyer, because his adulteries had simply become too flagrant, particularly with Ava Gardner.
And it was during those years that his fame was escalating, or I'm just trying to place in my own mind when his misbehavior actually began.
Right. Well, there are several chapters of misbehavior, but from 1947 until 1954, he had a terrible, he called it 7 years of Mondays. Terrible career decline. This was not only leaving his wife and young children, this was his records not selling, his record label dropping him, his MGM dropped him, his management dropped him. And he married Ava Gardner in 1951. They were a passionate love match. But virtually as soon as they married, the relationship began to go downhill, because her movie career was shooting up, shooting star-wise, and his was shooting down. Everything was going downhill for him, and she began to get sick and tired of his moping around. She was very much Frank's equal in a lot of ways, and very similar to him, very impatient with him. But she did him one enormous favor during those years, during those terrible years. And in answer to your question, the misbehavior really began then. He was very down. He began drinking then. I think that he relied on Jack Daniels for the rest of his life. And whenever he drank, he was a mean drunk.
And what was the favor Ava Gardner did for him?
Well, contrary to Mario Puzo's wonderful novel, The Godfather, and the wonderful movie by Francis Ford Coppola, there was no horse's head placed in a movie producer's bed to get the Sinatra-like singer the important movie role in From Here to Eternity. In fact, Ava Gardner, who had grown sick of Frank's moping around, went to Harry Cohn, the head of Columbia Pictures, and told Harry Cohn, who was widely renowned as the biggest lecher in Hollywood, which was saying something in those days, that she would do a movie for him for free if he would give, if Cohn would give Sinatra a screen test for From Here to Eternity. Cohn looked her up and down and thought, well, what else will Ava Gardner give me for free if she does this movie? So he gave Sinatra the screen test, and as it turned out, Eli Wallach, who had done a fantastic screen test, was otherwise engaged doing a play in New York, and Sinatra aced the screen test and got the role as Private Maggio and won the Oscar.
It was an extraordinary portrayal.
He really identified with that character.
Truly. I must say there are probably lots of younger people listening and maybe older people as well who are saying, why in the world should we be glorifying Frank Sinatra with either a big second volume biography or an hour on the Diane Rehm Show?
Yes.
The question becomes, in my mind, for you, how important a figure, musically or otherwise, Frank Sinatra has been.
He's an enormously important figure. I like to point out that this was a man who, when he was a kid, walked around Hoboken thinking that he heard the music of the spheres. I believe he really did hear the music of the spheres. I believe that this was a man of Mozartian level musical abilities, somebody who comes along once every couple of centuries. He was a true musical genius. At the same time, he was a tormented man. And as Pete Hamill has so wonderfully said, Pete Hamill, who wrote the wonderful short book, Why Sinatra Matters, and I agree that Sinatra matters, his shortcomings were regrettable. His shortcomings were regrettable. When he was tormented by many things, when he drank, he acted badly. We have many reasons. I always say that he was a genius in several ways, and one of the ways was in making himself dislikable. And so in the process, in the 10 years I spent writing these two books, I very frequently disliked Sinatra, but I was never bored with him for a second.
I understand that
and
very
I
well.
I still get goosebumps every time I hear him sing, and that is the legacy.
And let's do that. Let's hear I've Got the World on a String, because you say that was one of the songs that really brought him back.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go.
Did he, at this point, have the world on a string?
He did not. He was beginning to have the world on a string. But the way life works, life is always complicated. He had been dropped by Columbia Records, and he was signed by Capitol Records. A brilliant young Capitol executive named Alan Livingston signed Sinatra. When Livingston told his sales force that he had signed Frank Sinatra, they all groaned because Sinatra's career was so down at that point. Livingston teamed up Sinatra with an unknown young arranger whose name you might know, a young man named Nelson Riddle. Nelson Riddle arranged this great track. And by the way, this was April of 1953 when Sinatra recorded I've Got the World on a String. After After the final take, after the take was in the can, Sinatra said, "I'm back, baby. I'm back."
He knew it.
He knew it, but he wasn't quite back because at that point, Ava Gardner was in Spain with a bullfighter.
Oh, my.
And he was beginning to make From Here to Eternity, but it wouldn't be released till August. And he had a very rough year ahead of him. It wasn't until the year 53 turned into 54 that the comeback really began. Pantages Theater and the Oscar on that night of March 25th.
So when he found out that Ava Gardner was with a bullfighter, what did he do?
In November of 1953, in the New York apartment of his friend, the songwriter Jimmy Van Heusen, Sinatra slit his left wrist very deeply. He was taken to Mount Sinai Hospital. The story was put out that he had been hospitalized for exhaustion. It was a very, very difficult time for him. He came back after a few weeks and was on the Colgate Comedy Hour, a popular TV show of the time, and you could see, his left cuff, of his tuxedo shirt was covering a bandage on his left wrist.
James Kaplan, his new volume, Sinatra, the Chairman. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. What I am so entranced by and have always been is the way that Sinatra could work a phrase,
yes.
Work a note,
yes.
Massage,
yes.
Each of those.
Yes, incomparable. And this absolutely, in my mind, unique ability. You hear it a little bit in Billie Holiday, I think a bit in Judy Garland as well, but there are many great voices out there. Only Sinatra has the ability to make you feel that as he is singing the song, he is feeling these feelings and thinking these thoughts in the moment that he is singing them.
I want, therefore, to go back to his younger days,
yes.
To the days before he began singing professionally. What was he doing that developed this voice? How was his home life?
Well, he idolized Bing Crosby as a young guy walking around Hoboken, New Jersey, and he put on airs. I think too of William Faulkner, who strutted around Oxford, Mississippi. They used to call him Count No Count, another little man who put on airs. Sinatra, as a young man in Hoboken, felt he was going to be the best singer in the world. Well, what reason did he have for feeling that? He had this incredible ear, an ear that comes along once every couple of hundred years, these Mozartian gifts, but nobody knew that till he began to sing. And when he first began to sing, the voice wasn't quite there yet. He had to develop it. He eventually did take voice lessons, and he studied at the back of the great Tommy Dorsey, studied breath control, he studied phrasing. He also frequented West 52nd Street in New York, which in those days was an entire block of jazz clubs, and heard these great musicians, Lester Young, Teddy Wilson, and especially Billie Holiday.
What were his parents like?
His mother was very similar to Frank. Dolly Sinatra was a volcanic presence. She was under 5 feet tall. She was a Democratic ward healer in Hoboken. She was also a midwife and an abortionist. She was quite a character her whole life. His father was a weak figure in Frank's life. His name was Marty. He was a prize fighter, unsuccessfully, when he was a young man, had tattoos all over his arms. He didn't talk much. He grunted instead of talking. Dolly was the power in the family, and Sinatra loved her, but he was afraid of her. He said in later years he never knew whether she was going to hug him or hit him, and that was literally the case.
The artistry of Frank Sinatra's voice is probably as well demonstrated in this clip as any other.
Sky, so vast is the sky, with faraway clouds just wandering by. Where do they go? Oh, I don't know, don't know. Wind that speaks to the leaves, telling stories that no one believes. Stories of love belong to you and to me. Oh, Gingy, if I only had words, I would say all the beautiful things that I see when you're with me, oh my Gingy. Oh Gingy, like the song.
It sounds as though he's taking each word and each phrase and putting a velvet layer on it.
It's an amazing album. This is the great Sinatra Jobim album he made in January of 1967 with another great musical genius, the Brazilian composer and performer Antonio Carlos Jobim. There's an incredible backstory about this album and about that time in Sinatra's life, but I can say very quickly that this was, despite the gorgeous serenity of this album, this was a time of furies in Sinatra's life, absolute furies. So many things were going on. He had just married Mia Farrow. Howard Hughes had taken over Las Vegas. Sinatra's credit at the Sands Hotel Casino had been cut off, and in a famous incident the previous September, Sinatra had gotten into a fight with the casino manager at the Sands and had his front teeth knocked out by the casino manager at the Sands. And 4 months later, he's making this sublime album. There's no accounting for Sinatra.
There is a question. You bring up Mia Farrow.
Yes.
And the portion of your book regarding his attraction to Mia Farrow,
yes,
who was how many years younger than he?
When they married, 30 years younger. She was 19. He was 49.
And what he had written was that what he wanted was a young woman who would give up her work and focus,
yes,
solely,
yes,
and completely,
yes,
on him.
And that was not Mia Farrow. The initial attraction, of course, was sexual. That was a great deal of it. But also, Sinatra was a brilliant man, and Mia Farrow is a brilliant woman. And I think that he was aware of that from the get-go. This is a woman who was deeply sensitive, who was literary, musical, and extremely gentle. And I think he really was in love with her for a while. She was also enormously ambitious. She wanted to be a movie star. He did not want her to be a movie star.
And he thought that by marrying her, she would agree not to be a movie star.
You know...
I mean, really.
And no, he did. He really didn't see it coming. And I think that he felt he was so much in the driver's seat that he could command her to cease working. He told her not to do Rosemary's Baby, that she would stop doing that movie and come and act with him on this movie called The Detective. Well, Roman Polanski was shooting very, very slowly. She finished Rosemary's Baby, and she was served divorce papers on the set of Rosemary's Baby.
Wow. And here is a tweet from Joanne. Does your guest believe that Sinatra was the father of Mia Farrow's son, Ronan.
I strongly believe, I can't prove it. Petri dishes at my disposal, but I can tell you this. A couple of things. Of course, many people have made a big fuss about the great resemblance of Ronan Farrow.
Extraordinary
to Frank Sinatra, resemblance. But I would direct them immediately to two images. One is a picture of Mia Farrow's late father. He died very young. John Farrow, movie director, who is the spinning image of Ronan Farrow.
Ah.
And I would direct the listener also to a photograph of Mia Farrow at age 19 on the set of Peyton Place, where you look at that face and she is simply the spinning image of Ronan Farrow. We all know children who look like one parent or the other. And further, I will just say very quickly that Ronan Farrow was conceived in March of 1987. In December of 1986, Sinatra had serious intestinal surgery. He had 12 feet of intestine taken out. He was wearing... There's no other way to say this except clinically, he's wearing a colostomy bag. He was, Frank Sinatra was in Hawaii at that point with his wife, Barbara, and he was more or less incapacitated. He was not the father of Ronan Farrow.
All right. We've put that one to rest, at least for now.
Sorry I had to say it, but
I think that... the world really turned against Frank Sinatra when he left his first wife, Nancy.
Yes.
She's
a great woman. She is a great woman.
A
great woman to this day. She is 98 years old. She has her wits about her completely. And she was a kind of heroine of my first book and more in the background in the second book, but still a heroine and still a heroine to me, an extraordinary woman of great spirituality, of great moral fiber, a wonderful mother to her three children, and a woman of enormous patience. I think she never fell out of love with Frank Sinatra, despite all his misbehavior.
And what did she do after he left her?
She lived her life. She never remarried. She was a mother to her children. People sometimes would ask her why she never remarried, and she would smile and say, after Frank Sinatra. And she meant it. I think they maintained a relationship, Nancy, Big Nancy, they call her, Big Nancy and Frank, until the end of his life. And even Frank's daughter, Tina, asserts that later in Frank Sinatra's life, there was still a romantic, and occasionally a romantic relationship between his first wife and Sinatra.
Like going home.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And he finally died after what?
Well, in certain ways, it's amazing how long he lived. He died at age 82. His heart gave out on him. He had cancer, but that's not what killed him. This is a man who, throughout his life, smoked three packs of unfiltered Camels a day and drank probably a fifth of Jack Daniels a day. It's amazing he held out as long as he did. All you can cite is good genetic luck and an enormous life force. But in May of 1998, that heart finally gave out. His mind had been giving out for a long time. He was on a lot of, he had self-medicated with Jack Daniels for many years. But then he began, as he lost his faculties, there were a number of medications, and that mixed with the alcohol did not help him.
How did he live at the end? How was he being cared for?
He was being cared for at home in Beverly Hills. He had to leave his beloved Palm Springs compound, moved to Beverly Hills. His wife, Barbara, saw that he was taken care of. There were in-home helpers. There were nurses. He was seen frequently by doctors, but he became more and more a shut-in, more and more isolated from the world. He stopped. His last performance was in February of 1995, and after that, there were 3 years of really just being at home.
James, we have not talked about the Rat Pack.
Yes.
Tell us about who made that up, how it came together, and what was its central focus in addition to liquor and women?
Well, I love the way you put it. When you say made it up, that's exactly right. In my mind, the Rat Pack is a grand myth, and it's a myth that's extremely seductive. Even to me, after all I know about it, it's still seductive. It forms really the basis of Sinatra's mystique. It all happened in Las Vegas in early 1960 when several things converged, several factors converged. The movie was being made called Ocean's 11, which of course became the Rat Pack movie. And John Fitzgerald Kennedy was campaigning for president and was stopping in Las Vegas in early 1960. So you had all these performers, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., all performed at the Sands, and then the adjuncts, the ancillaries, Peter Lawford and Joey Bishop. And at first, it was all improvised, really. At first, all these performers, the three main performers, Frank and Dean and Sammy, were going to, during the weeks of January and February 1960, were going to perform separately. But they were making this movie, they were having fun, they began to sort of heckle each other and get up and interrupt each other's acts. And that became the basis of the Rat Pack. It all looks and sounds a lot more glamorous than it really was. There was an enormous amount of alcohol, enormous amount of misogyny, and some very bad racial joking. It doesn't hold up at all today about Sammy.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. There was, I won't say a moment because it lasted a lot longer than that, when the group, as we shall call them, was apparently, they thought, invited to stay at the home of the U.S. ambassador to London.
Yes.
Joseph Kennedy.
Yes, yes.
And then what happened?
Well, I'm thinking of two different stories, and a similar story I'm thinking of is when President Kennedy, in spring of 1962, planned a trip west. I'm not sure if we're talking about the same thing.
I think we're talking about first when they were going to London and Kennedy had, the ambassador had purportedly invited them to stay with him.
Yeah. Well, I believe on that stay, Sammy Davis Jr. might have been disinvited. The ambassador was, how shall I put this? He could be intolerant. But I was also thinking of, if I may, the moment in March of 1962 when President Kennedy was planning to go spend some time having fun and sun at Frank Sinatra's Palm Springs compound. And he was abruptly advised strongly by his brother, the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, that he could not shouldn't, but could not stay at Frank Sinatra's place. Well, why was this? J. Edgar Hoover had recently notified the Attorney General that the girlfriend of the president, a young woman named Judith Campbell, was also having an affair with the head of the Chicago Mafia, a man named Sam Giancana. This was a potential powder keg, a scandal of enormous proportions. And Sinatra was the one who had introduced Judith Campbell to the president, and Bobby Kennedy said, "You can't stay there." The president stayed instead at Bing Crosby's house in Palm Springs. This was an enormous humiliation to Sinatra, public humiliation. He was furious. He took it all out on Bobby Kennedy and Peter Lawford, who was the bearer of the bad news. And that was the beginning of Sinatra's turn to the right politically.
James Kaplan and the second and final volume of his two-volume biography is titled Sinatra, the Chairman. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. James Kaplan is with me. His new book, the second and final volume in his biographical account of the life of Frank Sinatra, this volume titled Sinatra, the Chairman. And before we go on, we should talk about that title, the chairman.
Yes.
Who gave it to him and why?
There was a well-known disc jockey in New York named William B. Williams on WINS. And he was a huge Sinatra fan, played Sinatra's records constantly and passionately, sometimes had Frank on the show. And in the late 1950s, William B. Williams, silver of tongue, simply laid this nickname on Sinatra. It was one of those nicknames like the boss or the count or the duke, the chairman of the board. I was initially going to call this second volume Sinatra the chairman of the board, but I felt that it would be stronger just to call it the chairman, because it really is a book about power.
Here's an interesting email from Susan in Durham, North Carolina. She says, Nancy and Frank Sinatra furnished their apartment from my grandfather's store, Zimmerman's Furniture in Jersey City. And Nancy invited both my grandparents over for coffee. It happened to be the day Frank walked in and told his wife he was leaving her for Ava Gardner. So despite Frank's immense talent, my grandfather always called him that bum.
That bum, sure. Well, he acted like a bum toward Nancy.
And here is an email from Jeff in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. I've read that Frank Sinatra was extremely difficult to work with when making films in Hollywood.
Yes.
In Shelley Winter's book, he refused to do more than one take.
Yes.
And if there were technical problems while filming, too bad.
Too bad.
That shot didn't get filmed. Wonder what your guest has heard of his behavior as an actor.
He hated making movies. He hated it. He was a constitutionally deeply impatient man, and I don't know if you've ever been on a movie set, but it's like watching paint dry.
Yeah.
The camera's on for 30 seconds, and there's 25 minutes of moving wires and lights around.
Right.
Sinatra hated that. He knew that his first take was his best take. He felt instinctually that it was his best take. But he became disliked in Hollywood because he didn't play nice. He really only behaved himself for directors who had a strong hand and whom he respected deeply. And ultimately, there were three of them. There was Fred Zinnemann from Here to Eternity. There was Otto Preminger, the man with the golden arm, and there was the great John Frankenheimer, Manchurian Candidate, Frank's finest movie.
What a movie that is.
It holds up.
It certainly does. Let's go to Rick in Mount Dora, Florida. Hi there. Rick, are you there?
Hello, Diane.
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
Diane, first of all, it's a distinct pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Listening forever. And Mr. Kaplan, I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about Nelson Riddle. You mentioned
yes.
him briefly.
Yes.
You know, for someone to be responsible for that sound that Frank had after he was a troubadour.
Yes. Yes, you really, when you're hearing the great albums that Sinatra and Riddle made in the 1950s for Capitol, you are hearing the collaboration. I don't like to throw around the word genius. It's often thrown around. But in this case, in the case of Riddle and Sinatra, it is exactly right. This was the collaboration of two musical geniuses.
What about Strangers in the Night?
Sinatra hated the song. I'm sorry to say that.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances we'd be sharing love?
before the night was through. Something in your eyes was so inviting. Something in your smile was so exciting. Something in my heart told me I must have you.
Why did he hate the song?
This was a period in Sinatra's life when rock and roll had hit the music business like an atom bomb. And Sinatra's old brand of music, which relied so heavily on the Great American Songbook and standards, was going by the wayside, or so it seemed. Rock and roll was coming in. Sinatra had a new young producer named Jimmy Bowen. Jimmy Bowen heard this melody in a spy movie, of all things, James Garner spy movie. The melody was composed by a German named Bert Kampfert. And Jimmy Bowen, the producer, said, if you can get me a lyric to that song, I can make it a hit. And he got a lyric, and he brought it to Sinatra, and they made it a hit. But Sinatra hated the song. He hated with a passion. He would announce in concert, I hate this song.
Really?
He would sing it anyway, because people loved it.
Just a glance away, a warm embracing dance away. Ever since that night, we've been together, lovers at first sight. In love forever, it turned out so right. For strangers in the night.
All right, let's go to Bob in Hershey, Pennsylvania. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you.
Sure.
I was wondering, I had heard this, and I'm wondering if Mr. Kaplan can comment on all those years working with Tommy Dorsey. Is it true that Frank Sinatra kind of developed the phrasing of the notes, the way he sang, kind of to be similar to the way a trombone plays, kind of extending the mouth, bringing it back? And I had another question. I've never heard anybody talk about it. I'm wondering what role, if any, you know, did Frank have any religious beliefs, and were they expressed in any particular way?
Well, to answer the first, Frank was not particularly religious. He would go to church every once in a great while, but perhaps he felt that that even confession could not absolve him of all his manifold sins. Not very religious. And what you say about Tommy Dorsey is exactly right. Tommy Sinatra sang with Dorsey's band from 1939 until late 1942. Dorsey was a brilliant trombone player with incredible breath control, incredible phrasing. And Sinatra picked up a great deal from Dorsey, including a trick of holding his breath for what seems, when you listen to him, an incalculably long time.
He did a lot of swimming.
Yes.
In order to do
swam laps underwater to build up his lung power. And when he made an album, he would go into training and he would cut down on his smoking, believe it or not, cut down from maybe 3 packs a day to 1 pack a day. But he was Sinatra. He was very impatient on a movie set, but when it came to recording, that's where it all was for him, and he would do as many takes as it took.
Somebody once said they stood behind him trying to watch how his back might move so that they could understand his breath control. And then someone spoke about a hole in his mouth.
Yes. Well, Tommy Dorsey had a trick, since he was a trombone player, of taking a sneak breath. He would widen his mouth, and at each side of the mouthpiece, you couldn't quite see it because the mouthpiece obscured most of his mouth, he would widen his mouth and form tiny openings on each side of the mouthpiece and take in a breath. If you watch Sinatra on YouTube, watch him on any video where he is singing, you'll occasionally see him do something that looks almost like a smile. He widens his mouth. It's exactly the same thing that Dorsey did. And he takes a breath from the corners of his mouth the same way. Yeah.
I want to ask you about two other women in Frank Sinatra's life. Lauren Bacall.
Yes.
And Marilyn Monroe.
Yes. Well, Lauren Bacall was an almost. There were rumors that Frank Sinatra and Lauren Bacall were having an affair even while Bacall's husband, Humphrey Bogart, was sick and then lay dying. They're very unpleasant rumors to hear, but I think they might have been true. After Bogart died in early 1957, they dated heavily, Sinatra and Bacall, and Sinatra indeed proposed to Bacall. But a very unfortunate thing happened. A friend of theirs, a literary agent named Swifty Lazar, was present when Frank popped the question. Lazar leaked the news to the gossip columns, and the news got out, and Frank flew into a fury that this news had been leaked. He wanted it kept private. He wanted it kept just between him and Bacall.
But why would he do it when Swifty Lazar was present if he wanted it kept quiet?
Tina Sinatra said, "My father, his third child, my father was a deeply feeling man who was unable to attain an intimate relationship." That was the pattern for Sinatra's life. And so here you have a man who asked a woman to marry him with another person present. Sinatra lived in the public. He most often hated it, but he lived in the public. He couldn't stand to be alone. At the same time, he couldn't form an intimate relationship. And when it came to Marilyn Monroe, the same held true. Marilyn Monroe was a deeply needy woman. She was a train wreck. And worst of all for Sinatra was the fact that her personal hygiene was not the best. She was a mess. Every place she lived was a rat's nest with books and bottles and God knows what lying all over the floor. She was frequently disheveled, not always washed. Sinatra was obsessively clean. He took 3 or 4 showers a day. His fingernails were exquisitely manicured. So despite the fact that he felt deeply for her, he called her Norma Jean, which was her real name, felt deeply for her and I think loved her in his way, and of course there was a sexual attraction, it was never a relationship that was going to stay for that reason.
Was it he who introduced Marilyn Monroe to President Kennedy?
It was, and it was a relationship that... That Marilyn Monroe became obsessive about, and President Kennedy, in his extremely pragmatic way, was fascinated and titillated, and then when time came to move on, as he always did, he moved on.
But his brother?
His brother, Robert Kennedy, I think, had a kind of a big crush on Marilyn Monroe. And Marilyn Monroe, with her fascination with the president, formed a kind of fascination by proxy with Robert Kennedy. But there wasn't the same animal magnetism there.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think one song that sort of epitomizes Frank Sinatra and his manner of living life in his own way is this one.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full. I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this. I did it my
Tell me about this song, Jay.
Frank didn't like the song. It was written by Paul Anka, and Sinatra felt that the lyrics, Sinatra was always exquisitely attuned to lyrics and lyricists. He felt that the lyrics of the song were too on the money, too direct, and at the end that they were too boastful. And he was a swaggering man, a man of enormous presence and ego, but he was not a braggart. He was not a braggart. He felt the song was braggartly, and he would announce to audiences he didn't like the song, but audiences demanded it. And so much of what makes a superstar is what we feel about that star. We want My Way to reflect Sinatra's soul. It feels like it should reflect Sinatra's soul. He was more complicated than that, but that's hard to tell audiences.
And it's so interesting, as you mentioned, that he made a right turn politically.
Yes, he did.
Which is also somehow epitomized by this song, My Way.
Yes, he did. He began campaigning for Ronald Reagan for governor in 1970, and his many Democratic friends, Frank had been a dyed-in-the-wool FDR Democrat, were horrified. And Sinatra told them, "I am going to do what I please." And he did.
I've loved, I've laughed and cried, I've had my fill, my share of losing, and now as tears subside, I find it all so amusing.
James Kaplan, what a pleasure to talk with you.
Absolute pleasure to talk with you, Diane.
Thank you. The book is titled Sinatra, the Chairman. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Ring.
Oh no, not me. I did it my way. For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not to say the things he truly. Yes, it is.